Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Charles McGrath about the great short story writer William Trevor.
He's not a metaphorical writer. He's not an imagistic writer. Nothing in Trevor is ever compared to anything else the way we get in Updike.
New York Times reporter Patricia Cohen is here to tell us about the digital humanities. Alexandra Jacobs and Julie Bosman are here to talk about Steve Martin, comedian and accomplished novelist.
Steve Martin is exactly the opposite of what you think he might be like in person. He's very serious, he's very quiet, he's very exact, he doesn't smile much.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. That's all coming up after the break.
This episode of the Book Review Podcast is brought to you by the AARP Auto Insurance Program from The Hartford and by Ford, makers of the new Ford Fiesta.
Sometimes great writers don't have anything particularly new for us, but it sounds new anyway. There's a new collection by one of the greatest of all short story writers, William Trevor. It's called Selected Stories. It's reviewed for us by the also great Charles McGrath, writer at large for The New York Times and my esteemed predecessor. And Chip is here to talk about Trevor. Hi, Chip.
Hi.
Chip, William Trevor is in some ways an old-fashioned, some might even say conventional writer, yet the short stories are enormously powerful. They are just as strong and upsetting when you read them now as some published many, many years ago. What is the key to this man's great artistry, if we can grasp it at all?
I think in part it's that he has tapped into the essentialness of storytelling. I mean, the stories in many cases seem old-fashioned. They begin almost in a kind of once-upon-a-time fashion, and he has tapped into that, but not in a fussy or old-fashioned way. He has stripped away a lot of the needless fussiness of short stories. It's interesting that before he became a writer, he was a sculptor for many years, a failed sculptor. But you sense in his stories this a kind of paring away. He's a great lever-outer as well as a putter-in. And there's a kind of spareness, and he gets to certain essential themes about loss, about age, about heartbreak, about loneliness. And he has the great gift to come back to these themes over and over and over again and find something new to say or to make you feel about them.
And Chip, Ireland's on everyone's minds these days. How much does he descend from that great tradition of writers?
Well, he's very much a part of it up to a point. The writer Colm Tobin once said that if you read Trevor, you would know the Dubliners happened, but you'd never know about Ulysses of Finnegan's Wake. In that sense, he's not a modernist writer, but he's very tied into Ireland. He was born there. He grew up there. He has lived now for many, many years in England, but at least half his stories are set in Ireland. And you could make a case that they're the better ones or the better of the best. There's something about the plight of that land that still appeals to him. And what's curious about his stories, but the Irish stories in particular, is that they don't change very much. Trevor hit the ground running back in the early 60s with a style that he had evolved somehow, and it hasn't changed much. Trevor then is Trevor now, and you'd be hard-pressed to pick a story from the 60s and one from the 90s and say which is which. And his Ireland hasn't changed much. There's a few references to the Troubles in the stories, but not many. In one story, there's a small reference to the pedophilia crisis in the Catholic Church in Ireland. But basically, he's going at the fact that Ireland doesn't seem to change very much.
Chip, you talked about Trevor's style, how it was formed early and has not changed much. How important is it for a great short story writer also to be a great prose artist? Is he a great prose artist?
He is, but not in the way that we tend to think. He's not an Updike in the sense that he's not a metaphorical writer. He's not an imagistic writer. Nothing in Trevor is ever compared to anything else the way we get an Updike or even the way we get, say, an Alice Munro. It's a sparer style, but it is a style. And the fact that it has endured for so long without changing, without needing to be changed, says a lot about its value.
Thanks a lot, Chip. That's Charles McGrath, who this week reviews Selected Stories by William Trevor. Coming up, more of Inside the New York Times Book Review.
This episode of the Book Review Podcast is brought to you by the AARP Auto Insurance Program from The Hartford. The AARP Hartford Program can save drivers over the age of 50 $384 on auto insurance. Join the more than 3 million AARP members who are enjoying benefits that include lifetime renewability, a lifetime repair guarantee, and a 6-point claim guarantee. Customers describe the claims experience as fast, easy, and outstanding. Check them out today and get an 8-minute quote. Go to AARP.thehartford.com/podcast.
What on earth is digital humanities? The Times' great culture and ideas reporter Patricia Cohen has been on the case. She had her first story in the paper with more to come, and she's here to talk about it. Welcome, Patty.
Oh, thanks. Hi, Sam.
So tell us, please, what are digital or is digital humanities?
Right. Well, digital humanities, I think the best way to think about it is kind of an umbrella term that really covers a lot of ground that has anything to do with technology and how can you use that technology in the service of knowing more about the humanities, literature, history, philosophy. You know, we have an unbelievable resources now that scholars previously didn't have, these incredible databases which scholars can search in ways that they were never able to before, and all these kind of technological toys and visualization techniques in order to look at data and figure out, try and draw new questions and find new things that we couldn't know before.
Okay, let's get down to cases. Let's take, say, the Civil War, probably the single subject most written about, the most books, most scholarship. What can these digital resources tell scholars and readers like ourselves that we couldn't have known before?
Right. Well, for example, there's somebody working on using new mapping technology to look at the topography of Civil War battlefields to figure out what may have given advantages to the North or the Southern Army in ways that you would actually have to go walk the battlefield step by step to kind of see and look at from different perspectives. But here you could do that virtually through a computer. Another example, let's say, of something that we know really well about ancient Rome. We can have these 3D models of ancient Rome that are able to tell you things about the architecture, about flow of traffic, living conditions that you could not have otherwise figured out without these kind of virtual 3D models.
Okay, so this sounds like cutting-edge scholarship. And as we know, people who were kind of raised in the humanities, a lot of it is about tradition and preserving older ways of thinking and study. So what do, let's say, really established older generation scholars make of this kind of research?
Right. Well, you've keyed into, I think, what is really the essential or the most crucial debate going on now, which is what will we lose? There is something about the very nature of the humanities in terms of questions of aesthetics, meaning, significance that defy quantification. And I think the answer that these new generation of scholars would give is we're not saying one is a substitute for the other. We're not saying throw out the textual base interpretive way of doing things. They're saying, here's a new tool that can add to what you're doing. So, in fact, we got a lot of comments on the story, and a lot of people pose that exact question. But I think the response is it's not an either or. It's a widening the circle, making it bigger.
And what about, Patty, the application to students in the classroom or in textbooks or in this ways they have of absorbing new information?
Right. Well, actually, that is going to be another story in the series that I'm going to look at particularly. And there's already a lot of classrooms that are interpreting and using these technologies, and professors are teaching. It's a kind of alliance of the techies and the geeks, or the techies and the fuzzies, I should say, how they refer to it at Stanford. And teams of teachers matching up to teach students how to use these tools, to do searches in databases, another story that I'm going to work on that's going to come out soon, is about looking at using the incredible resources now that we have Google Books and other vast databases that linguists can look at to look at structure of languages and grammar in a way that they didn't have the ability to before. If you think about it, all historical study is in some way anecdotal. You know, you could read 3 books, you could read 300 books, but you haven't read 3 million books. But now, if you could do these kind of quantified research searches, you can find out things that you may not have realized before.
So in other words, you could search for a particular idea or, let's say, a word and actually search it through all of the known or almost all of the known literature we have going back to antiquity.
Exactly. And in fact, there's a couple of projects. One is going back to look at, I think, like Encyclopedia or Encyclopedia Britannica as far back and look at it over 100 years and look at how concepts and items changed over the years. And in that way, you can kind of track the history of ideas. When did ideas become introduced and accepted that they suddenly became big enough and important enough to have a listing in the encyclopedia? When did some other ideas fall out? There's another project going on looking at scientific texts and textbooks to see the same thing, to track the history of scientific ideas. When did things enter into the textbook that became known? When did other ideas or concepts drop out?
So in some ways then, instead of being in conflict with the traditional form of scholarship, this is actually enlarging and enhancing that.
I think so. And I think we should remember, you know, this is still in its infancy. And there's lots of experimentation. There's lots of different varieties of it. You know, I'm sure there'll be lots of silly applications like there are in every endeavor in scholarship and life. But I think there'll also be a lot of interesting things to come out of it.
And any possibility this will trickle down below the college level to the high school or middle grade level? Or are we really talking about university and college scholarship?
I think there's two, as I said, you know, again, digital humanities is kind of this umbrella term, and there's a lot of things that fall under that rubric. There's a lot of research, very high-level research, I would say, that's going on. But a lot of it is also presentation of information and data. And a lot of the projects that have been funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities, for example, are designed as teaching tools through K through 12 or museum exhibits as a way of presenting information and data in a way that's much more inviting and easier to understand, especially for kids.
Thanks a lot, Patty.
Thank you.
That's Patricia Cohen, New York Times reporter, Culture and Ideas, who's been discovering the world of digital humanities. Up next, Steve Martin, novelist, a conversation with Alexandra Jacobs and Julie Bosman.
This episode of the New York Times Book Review Podcast is brought to you by Ford, makers of the new 2011 Ford Fiesta. With an EPA-estimated 40 miles per gallon highway, no other car in its class is more fuel efficient. The new Fiesta has also been designed to deliver a ride that's responsive and energized, and it offers 15 standard and available features like push-button start and leather-trimmed seats. That's the 2011 Ford Fiesta. Ford invites you to drive one at a dealer near you.
Steve Martin is a man of many incarnations, including novelist, and he's got a new book called An Object of Beauty. It was reviewed for us by Alexandra Jacobs, who is an editor at the Style section of the New York Times, also a prolific journalist who writes for us a lot, and she's here to talk about Steve Martin's new book. Alexandra, Steve Martin is actually a fairly serious writer. Shop Girl was a bestseller and well-reviewed. How's the new novel?
I wouldn't call Shop Girl a serious novel. I felt it was sort of a slip of a novel. It was well received, I think, as a light entertainment, and it was sort of like, oh, here's this funny, wild and crazy guy who can write a novel. You know, what else can he do?
And how's the new one?
The new one is great. This one, I felt, marks Steve Martin's arrival as a novelist.
So what goes on in the novel?
What goes on in the novel? The novel is set in the heady, giddy period of the mid-90s to just after to the early aughts, I guess, are we calling it? What goes on, the protagonist is a woman named Lacey Yeager, and she is an ambitious would-be gallerist or art dealer.
Where?
In New York City.
And what does she do in her gallerism?
The question is, what doesn't she do, Sam? She sleeps with men. She connives. She contrives. She manipulates. And yet somehow, I at least found her a tremendously winning, engaging, sympathetic character.
And what about as a writer? Does he really know what he's doing? Does he know how to write a novel?
I was mesmerized by this book. I would recommend this to anybody. I mean, it was exquisitely paced, I thought. And also his knowledge of the art world is, I mean, I know very little about art, and I felt that here the narrator of the novel is an art critic, and there's just a tremendous amount of information in there.
Julie Bosman, you recently wrote a profile of Steve Martin for the New York Times.
Steve Martin is exactly the opposite of what you think he might be like in person. He's very serious. He's very quiet. He's very exact. He doesn't smile much. We had arranged over a series of, I think, 6 phone calls to meet at a gallery on the Upper East Side where we could walk around and look at art and talk about art. And those 6 phone calls consisted of Steve Martin calling me and saying, "Hi, Julie, it's Steve Martin. Okay, are you sure you want to go to the Aquavella? Maybe we should go to the Gagosian. Maybe we should go to the King Cole Bar instead. Okay, let me think about this. I'll call you back. Hi, Julie, it's Steve Martin. Okay, I think we should go to the King Cole Bar. I'll see you there." And it was that over and over and over again. And I don't know quite what to make of that, except that maybe there's a little bit of the control freak in him, a little bit of, just wanting to make sure he knows what he's doing and you know, over preparation. So once we got there, he really wasn't interested in looking at art at all. He wanted to go to the libraries within the galleries, which was interesting because he would pull a book off the shelf and say, "Oh, Arthur Dove. Oh, let me show you the Dove I used to own. Oh, I don't have it anymore. Well, I can't tell you, you know, what happened to it. It's a long story." So he was a difficult interview, and that was pretty much what I had been told would happen. You know, he was not very forthcoming with a lot of personal details, but he was interested in talking about the book and the writing process and how he had kind of stored up decades of observations about the art world and how he wanted to get all that down in a novel.
Alexandra, Julie said that Steve Martin is not very funny in person, and you hear this all the time about comedians, that they're actually sort of pent up and angry, and humor becomes their mode of expressing the anger. Is this novel funny?
It is funny. It's incredibly observant about human behavior and human emotions and sort of the petty things we all do to get ahead, to advance our careers, to advance ourselves romantically. But it's also, it's about love in the end. And I found that its grip on love was sort of very touching. I mean, I'd also say the same. I mean, I found most of my many, this encounter you had with him seems consistent with me with the encounters I've had with some of my favorite authors. I always expect them to be, you know, I expect to fall in love with them the way I did with their books, and then I'm always disappointed when I meet them in person.
And maybe it's sort of an unfair standard. You know, we shouldn't expect comedians to be, you know, on their game all the time and, you know, amusing us. But it's kind of jarring to meet people and find out that they're just precisely the opposite
well,
that you would have thought.
I think they're different. I mean, you know, I'm married to one, so whatever. But I think there are different kind of comedians. They're the improvisational ones, and then there are ones who just sort of have their material. They work it over and, you know, they go on and off. And it sounds like he goes on and off.
Alexandra, you're married to a comedian?
Well, I'm married to he's a former, like Steve Martin, he's a former stand-up comic, but he's now a television.
And
he writes for Late Night.
And is he, like, monumentally unfunny and unamusing to be around?
He's actually tremendously funny, but some of his colleagues that I've met are not as funny.
Julie, when you're dealing with a subject as reticent as Steve Martin, then how are you able to write a lively, interesting profile of him for the New York Times? What do you do? You just take whatever you can extract from the little bit he gives you?
You go to war with the quotes that you have, I guess. you know, you try to extend the interview as long as you possibly can, and you transcribe very slowly and carefully to make sure that you got every bit of it. And I spent a little bit of time talking to our photographer who was there the whole time after it was over, just to kind of match my observations with hers and see if we could brainstorm a little bit. And I guess you just, some subjects are not as easy as others.
Did you hear from Steve Martin after your story ran in the paper?
No, not yet, but it's still early.
Thanks a lot, Alexandra Jacobs and Julie Bosman.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks, Sam.
Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. What's new on the list this week, Jenny?
James Patterson is back. Wait a second. Did he ever really go away? If it's November, it must be time for his latest Alex Cross book. They seem to be a mainstay of November, just like endless piped-in Christmas carols in the frozen pea aisle 2 weeks before Thanksgiving. This one is called Crossfire. It indeed enters at number one. And other than that, a lot of old-timers coming home for the holidays. John Grisham at number two with a confession. David Baldacci, Clive Cussler, Stephen King. Wake me up when it's January. Jonathan Franzen, he's been in the news in a perhaps not such a friendly way. His novel Freedom is down at number 19 on the extended list. He dropped off the printed list last week. But recently he topped another list. It's the Literary Review's list of nominees for the Bad Sex Writing Award. That one will be decided on Monday, so stay tuned.
Really? And Freedom?
Yep.
I like those sex scenes.
You should have quoted more of them in your review.
What about nonfiction?
George Bush still on top with his book Decision Points. I was sort of surprised he held off a strong challenge from Laura Hillenbrand, you know, the author of Seabiscuit. She's back with another big book called Unbroken. And Jay-Z, the king of the world, is at number three with his sort of collage-like autobiography, Decoded. Interestingly, he was at the New York Public Library recently. This seems to be the hot place for all musical superstars / aspiring authors to appear. Keith Richards was there a couple weeks ago, and now Jay-Z blows in to talk philosophy and hip-hop with his friend Cornel West. There was a lot of name-checking going on. One of the other questioners compared Jay-Z to Ezra Pound. And then Jay-Z himself was quoted as having once said of his old friend Biggie Smalls, "I was Plato to Biggie's Socrates."
So does that make Keith Richards Aristotle?
Maybe.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.